Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann. There's been a sea change in interest to decommoditize food in the U.S. Adding differentiated values back into our food system that will positively benefit human health and planetary stability is not just for the rogue or alternative market anymore. It's the non-GMO crops, the IPM, the organic certification, grass-fed beef and dairy, NAE, no growth hormones, sustainable practice, responsibly raised, local food, no synthetics, no dyes, no additives, and many, many more new monikers that work to fix a broken food system. In a previous episode, President and CEO of the Nobel Research Institute, Bill Buckner, explained that in order to reintroduce those values back into food, on the production side, we must evolve the operating system. That starts and ends by assigning value to essential natural resources used in producing any of these products. Fundamentally, in future food and production systems, all that comes down to soil, sweet water, carbon, and for aquatic production, ocean health. It's the belief of Nobel Research Institute, the largest private ag research center in the U.S., that was once married to an input-based conventional production model, that in order to enact change in our food systems and our production models, that we must incentivize farmers to partake in preserving and properly shepherding these essential building blocks that have so far been taken for granted in our country. Currently, these resources, the lifeblood of our food, are not even given a value on a balance sheet nor in a conventional production model. Soil and water can be our savior if we just start valuing them. Water may prove to be the change agent that will expedite an immediate conversation, but it's the depletion of soil health and desertification that could cause catastrophic impact in generations to come. Truth is, they're so interrelated, you can't really have one without the other. We rely on healthy soils to not just store water, but clean, percolate, and dole it out to crops, to the vegetation, and to the rainforests. All become interrelated from the soil up and result in carbon banking systems. Globally, on islands that are much more populated than our own, and equally in natural ecosystems once of plenty, soil and water, and thus our planetary stability, is under threat. A degradation practices of modern agriculture and expansion are real. 70% of available fresh water is already used in irrigating crops, and furthermore, every minute we're losing 30 football fields of rich topsoil throughout the globe. And to add some context to that, it takes 500 years to rebuild an inch of topsoil. So that's going to be a problem for our kids, and especially our grandkids. Stateside, we're acting like a spoiled Kavanaugh, in fact, thinking it's our birthright to plunder these essential resources of natural environments. 3 billion years to harmonize, and within a decade, we've begun to standing on the throat of natural order. But there are solutions, and they're not far afield. We've learned that there's vast opportunity to connect with natural systems and expedite practices that will build healthy soil, to clean water, to stabilize ecosystems through feeding ourselves on a shrinking and drying planet. Our avid listeners have become familiar with many of these techniques, and with many of the folks leading this charge. Today, we're going to look at it from a broader perspective. We're going to connect a few dots in the systems thinking approach to better management of our resources for our own good. For new audience members, this episode will be a great chance to get an overview of the whole picture from an expert who literally wrote the books on it. Today, we welcome Judith Schwartz to the show. Welcome, Judith.
Thanks so much.
You are welcome, and happy World Farm Animal Day.
Oh, goodness, you caught me there.
Huh? How about that? I just came across my Twitter feed today, and I said, I'm going to throw that in. How's that?
Sounds good.
Well, it's always nice to talk to another New Englander focused on global agricultural practice and human health and the correlation of planetary stability. So, you know, why mess around? Let's go for the big swing here and try to tackle some of these big problems. And you've dug deep into two of the major categories I talked about in the prelude, which is around regenerative natural resources for the value of soil and water. So on the soil health side of things, you are the author of a book, Cow Save the Planet, which is based on restoring large-scale ecological systems through holistic planning planned grazing, basically keeping animals out on the land's environmental or natural environments, and that it's about the management and not the animal that's the problem for the environment. So if you would tell our listening audience a bit more about your discoveries and also some of the additional information that you have found since publishing this book a few years back.
All right. Yeah. So the book is a look at soil. It's a look at soil as a hub for our many environmental, economic, and social challenges and for solutions. And basically, several years ago, I was introduced to the topic or to the notion of soil carbon, which no one was talking about at all. I mean, in fact, it was the fact that I didn't know anything about soil carbon that made me so interested in its potential. You know, so I had no idea, and I think many people still have no idea that the flip side of our problem of too much atmospheric CO2 is the lack of carbon in the soil. So when I learned about this and I started to understand that carbon in the soil creates fertility, that it allows for the storing of water, which is a huge, huge thing, as you alluded to. It's incredible. For every gram of soil organic carbon in the ground, that represents 8 grams of water that can be held in the soil. So when you look at the challenges that we're having right now, including floods, including droughts, including wildfire, the capacity to hold water in the ground is huge. So anyway, as I was getting very, very excited about this, I posed the question, okay, well, this is dandy. How do we return carbon back to the soil? And the broad answer was through regenerative agricultural practices. And the most specific practice that I came up with, the only people that were talking about this at the time were those who were employing holistic plant grazing, the use of livestock for large-scale land restoration. So that was the discovery for me. And as I went deeper into all the soil dynamics, just saw how all these dots were connected, how soil is central, healthy soil is central for biodiversity, because biodiversity starts in the soil. I mean, 95% of the biodiversity on land is held in the soil. I mean, I don't know how many soil geeks you've talked to, but, you know, when people start talking about, like, you know, the soil life and the nematodes and the worms and the fungi, I mean, really, you know, like, it's quite astounding. It's kind of, you know, talk about going down into a rabbit hole. Well, a wormhole gets you into some pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah, with I think the stat that adds to it is there's more living microbes in a tablespoon of soil than there are people on the planet, right? I mean, add some context of like how robust that ecosystem really is.
Exactly, that soil is alive. I mean, you know, growing up, what did I know? I just, you know, like soil was dirt.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a thing, but it's this living ecosystem. And the extent to which it is living has such a bearing on our food production, on our production of fiber, on the water cycle, and therefore on the climate. So it's a pretty that little handful of dirt, it's kind of a big deal. One thing I do want to correct you
is
that you said that it takes hundreds of years to build an inch of topsoil.
Yeah, okay. I should have said naturally.
Right? Oh, okay. So, thank you. Okay, I just think it's a
correction.
Really important point because topsoil, living soil, can be built rapidly. And knowing that really opens up so many possibilities for restoration of our lands and regeneration of our food systems.
Yeah, let's get into that because, you know, as you mentioned, one of the seminal elements of that is using food animals, especially ruminants, to get back on and pasture as a part of that trophic nutrient exchange. And that is one of the best practices of getting the engaged soil to sequester carbon. But that is so counterintuitive to what people hear in common vernacular, in the storyline, that it's the animals are the problem. So as you did your book tour and you spoke to individuals, how did you answer those questions? When people came to you and said, whoa, Judith, no, it's we have too many animals. That's the problem. We it's the methane, it's all these issues. What was your response to that?
Okay, so my sort of flip answer to that is that it's pretty cheap of us to blame animals for our failure to manage them appropriately. In other words, it's all a matter of management. So what I tend to do is invite people into really a thought experiment to think about, you know, what we consider to be healthy landscapes and think about places that you've been or times you've read about in the past, and animals and wildlife and birds. I mean, the our landscapes are rich in life, and how and that we can start to, if we understand that we could start to explore how animals are bringing life and enhancing life in the landscapes. And many people that I talk to believe that even with, you know, really, really creative uses of plants and in regenerative agriculture, that it's really that animals on the land are essential because of their action on the land. So, you know, I guess part of it is that I feel like we as a culture have become very disconnected from nature. So we tend to look at nature. Okay, so, well, the animals would be taking from the land. You know, if we have animals, you know, on the land, they're taking from it. And the same thing with plants. Like, if a plant is in the soil, it's taking the water that falls. It's taking the nutrients from the soil. But the truth is that in the case of both animals and plants, in functioning ecosystems, those plants and animals are giving back hugely to the landscape.
Yeah, the only animal that's taking from it in an extractive-based approach is us, right?
That's and we can change that too and start giving back to the land by managing it appropriately. Yeah, so shall I explain the basic dynamics of how animals help to build soil?
Perfect, if you would.
Okay, all right. All right, so you've got animals on the land. And, you know, again, to think about I'll refer to the work of Alan Savory. Many people may have heard of him before. He's originally from Zimbabwe, and over many years he was trying to puzzle out the question of why was the land healthier? You know, for him, it was in his childhood because he observed the landscape getting worse. Why was the land healthier when there were more animals? And it didn't make sense because they were basically told when he was working in the wildlife service that the land was suffering because there were too many animals. So he was trying to puzzle that out. And over many decades of observation, he came to a few different conclusions. One is that animals and grazing animals and grassland ecosystems co-evolved so that the land needs the animals in the same way that the animals need the land. Another concept was that land can be undergrazed or suffer from not enough impact in the same way that land can suffer from too much impact or be overgrazed. I'll leave it there because then we would get into different types of landscapes. But I'll just leave it there. So he came to understand, and you know, these are certainly observations that have been made by many pastoral communities and you know many groups of people in the past. But he put this together in a way that, well, certainly helped me understand it. So, okay, it makes sense that the animals, you know, they do fertilize the soil from their waste, and that's part of it. But also, the impact of their hooves is very important. So in a natural system, you've got, let's say, grazing animals, let's say wildebeest or zebra or, you know, or Cape buffalo, and, you know, they're grazing, they're eating, so they're nibbling has an effect on the plant. It stimulates the growth of plants. So at people who mow their lawn may realize that actually that seems to keep the plant growing more. You know, if it isn't grazed down too low, it does stimulate the growth of plants. It also exposes the growth points to sunlight. And then, you know, they're happily grazing, and then a predator comes along. And then the instinctive response is for those grazing animals to bunch up and then flee en masse. And then when they flee, they're trampling. And that trampling presses down decaying matter into the soil, plant matter. So that can be broken down by microbial life, that living soil that we talked about, the creatures, all the, you know, all that microbiology. And it also presses in, the trampling presses in seeds so that you get a chance for a diversity of plants to germinate. And there have also been, people have told me about cases where even just, and I've seen this actually, when the pressing, they're pressing in creates little pools, you know, like little craters where water can pool, so the water gets held onto the land a little bit more. So there are all these dynamics, and I'm sure multiple dynamics that we haven't even come to understand yet, because it's actually, it's a pretty complex thing. Now, just as an aside, yeah. I had a little bit of an experience with this. I've traveled, and I've seen a lot of changed landscapes, and I've seen a lot of examples of management, but I also got to do my own little experiment this summer. For the new book that I'm writing right now, we decided to have some sheep. And it was quite, we have about 12 acres here in Vermont. And it was actually extraordinary to see how the animals changed the land. And I mean, this is only for a few months, so I'm not saying that it improved it. You know, I think we'd need more time. But the way that they cleared, the way that they cleared the land, so they cleared a lot of brush, a lot of brambles, but also what they left, and how they fertilized it, and how they pressed in matter and seeds, and what they chose to eat, what they chose to leave. Anyway, it was all very interesting.
I think adding those tangible ways of looking at it and then making it applicable to yourself, that absolutely makes it so we materialize this. And to your point, we're so worried about finding out how to colonize Mars that we don't even look underfoot of these incredible ecosystems and environments that could unlock mysteries that we have no idea about. So we have great opportunity to move in the proper direction, right? So we'll leave it at that. And I do want to explore actually where you're headed for your next book. But I wanted to ask before we did that a bit more on the water side, on another book you wrote, Water in Plain Sight, Hope for a Thirsty World. Now, Judith, to my understanding, clean water just comes from turning on the tap, doesn't it? So what's the problem?
Oh, sure. No, water, often I talk about, you know, like the way that you're talking about it now, water, it's like this thing, like we get this thing. But I often like to think of water as a process, water as a verb rather than a noun. And because by looking at it that way, it helps us see how water works and how water connects to our actions, just as soil and soil carbon depend on how we treat our soil. Yeah, so I chose to write about water because a couple of things. One is that I came to, I did mention that by building soil carbon, you are able to keep more water on the land, and one way to build soil carbon and build healthy soil is through, proper management of animals. So I was very tuned into how water and land go together, and yet in conversations about our water challenges, including the California drought and the types of conversations that are happening here in Vermont about our waterways becoming polluted with agricultural runoff, people weren't making the connection between water and land, water and soil. So one source of mine, Brock Dahlman, talked about, instead of the watershed, when people think of water, they think about what they're really talking about is the pipe shed, like all the pipes, the faucets and the culverts and all that, how we're using technology to move water around,
right,
as opposed to how water really in nature is flowing through the ecosystem.
Yeah, it's we almost like the last mile delivery is what we're thinking about, right?
Right.
Yeah. And so what did you uncover about our perception or maybe lack thereof of appreciation of how these natural systems work for water?
That we are missing huge opportunities to enhance the quality of our water, the amount of water that's available to us, and that by understanding the connection, that the way that we manage land can give us better access to water. So just as an example, I mentioned that I did go to visit many ranches where they are using holistic plant grazing. And there's one area that we went to in Chihuahua, Mexico. And the ranches where we were, they're doing this and they have a lot of water and, there's very tall grass and it's green and it looks good and they've got tremendous biodiversity and just all these wonder, and their cattle are healthy. And then you can go a couple of miles away and it looks like you're in a desert. So one of my hosts, a rancher named Alejandro Carrillo, he would laugh and he would say that his neighbor kept coming to him and saying, well, of course your land looks better. You get more rain on your ranch. And, the humor of that is, they're right next to each other. So, they're sharing the same clouds. It's a matter of being able to hold on to that moisture and make use of it, as opposed to if you have bare soil, if nothing's growing there, then the moisture would just evaporate, or often what happens, it runs off immediately, and then you're losing soil, you're losing the nutrients, it's causing erosion, you're getting gullies, and you're having water quality problems elsewhere. So so it really makes a difference. And when I started this work, aside from Hurricane Irene, which was a kind of big deal, and at that point felt a little bit like a fluke, I felt like a lot of these problems were happening elsewhere, but more and more I'm seeing that these situations, the flooding that could have been avoided if more attention had been paid to land, that they're everywhere. So there are a lot of opportunities to do better.
It is a bit of a challenge when you start to look at it on the broad perspective. I mean, obviously, we have our country topography is very different, but you look at the issues that are happening, as you mentioned, in California with the deep water aquifer drilling, or really much of it's based off of the water rights and the issues with that and growing the wrong crops in deserts. And then you look what's happening in the middle of the country in the breadbasket with the Ogallala and the overtapping of our deep water aquifers and what's going to happen for unlocking the nutrients and the petrochemical fertilizers. And then to your point, all that runoff, 80% of those petrochemicals going into rivers and streams, which create algae blooms, all from these shortcut practices we're using in food production, which we think is providing cheap food for everyone to access. But the unintended consequences seems to be catching up with us. Is that some of the synopsis that you came to?
Yeah, it's certainly catching up to us. And I think that more people in food production are realizing this and starting to make changes. I mean, one unfortunate thing is that a lot of this gets politicized when, I mean, land function and water availability, I mean, that's kind of not really a political matter. It's happening. I mean, people have to deal with this every day, but I think so much does have to do with this kind of abstracted food supply that we have, because, you know, you have the food that you may buy in a grocery store, and then it's disconnected from where that food was grown. So it's just very hard for people to really understand the implications of how our food is grown if we don't really know how our food is grown. And then, like, you can have one product. It's not even that it's grown or produced in somewhere else, but it could be that it's produced from many places. So we have this situation where so much grain is being grown to feed animals, to feed livestock. So you have the grain imported and brought another place where the animals are. Then the animals might be shipped, or they might be sent from one location where they're on grass to another location where they're in a feedlot, and then moved again to be slaughtered, moved again to be packaged, moved again to be marketed. So you have all these places where you're having environmental impact, and it just gets so convoluted. I mean, the silliest thing is that by growing crops to feed the animals, not only are you using land that could otherwise produce food for humans, but you're also reducing the possibility of the positive impact that animals eating grass, you know, and living on grass can have.
Mm-hmm.
So it just makes no sense. It's, you know, a byproduct of policy and ignorance of how systems work and false economies.
Yeah. A compounding effect of mismanagement. And speaking of those that maybe mismanagement of policy, I read some excerpts from your 2017 congressional briefing where you brought many of your findings together from your two books, that you connected the living soil, the ability to store and lever and interchange with water. As we've talked about, it just seems to be common sense. Who did you share that with? Who was there, and what was the impetus for this, and what was the reaction you received?
Okay, it was a real interesting event. So this hearing, this congressional hearing, was called on by a Republican congresswoman named Cynthia Lummis from Wyoming, who is also a rancher. Now, what I didn't know at the time is that she was about to leave Congress. Okay, this was the end of her term. Okay, she was out of there. It was important, what I understand is that it was important for her to have this hearing happen, to put on the public record an understanding of the positive impacts of proper animal management. So the topic was, what is possible for our public lands in terms of animal management? So, and it was very helpful the way she framed this. She wasn't saying we have to have animals on land and then it would be this, you know, pro or, you know, yes we do, no we don't. You know, there was nothing to argue over. It was just, okay, let's just look and understand what the potential is. So this was in the middle of a very fraught political time. And in fact, there was a hearing right before ours that was something that was very much in the news. This was fall of 2016, September. And so, I mean, it's funny because I was there with a colleague, Byron Shelton from the Savory Institute, and we walk into, you know, the get settled in the room where we're about to have this hearing, and you know, we see all the networks, the cameras and everything, and you know, so we were joking, oh, you've all come to see us, and you know, well, actually no, we're just packing up. So all the crowds left. It was very sparse. There was a lot going on, so it was sparsely attended. And I also understand that because everything is filmed and recorded, that a lot of people, a lot of legislative staff, kind of sit at their desks and have the thing, you know, they're watching it while they're doing paperwork or something. But it did bring out, so there were about 7 or 8 legislators and some other people. And, you know, the questions were very good and got a really nice response from some people who were attending. And, I mean, it's in the public record, and that is potentially meaningful. It's something that if someone is doing research on this topic, they'll come across. Anyway, it was a very positive experience.
Well, yeah, I mean, to be honest, we probably would be accused, you being Vermont, I'm being in Massachusetts, as being on the liberal side of things. The fact that this was called by a more conservative group, and to be honest, the whole conservation movement was started from the right. It makes pragmatic sense. Maybe that is an opportunity for us to engage more of that group, because these are much more economically viable approaches to raising food, to dealing with climate change, to dealing with water issues that are, it's just, how do we get folks on either side of the aisle to start looking at it as not a sandbox short horizon perspective, but a longer horizon perspective? Now, I know that can open up many cans of worms about two-year terms and the whole practice, but I hope we have some leaders in there that are looking at shepherding these resources, these regenerative natural resources, from a different perspective. Did you get any of that feedback from the 7 or 8 folks that were there, or from the individuals watching C-SPAN that, you know, followed up with a tweet to you later on?
That's really hard to know, but I will say that it's important. Being on the East Coast, we don't have, you and I, or I certainly didn't have an understanding of how vast our public lands are. In the state of Nevada, 70% of the land is public land. And a lot of our public lands, including our national parks are kind of a different category, but these lands are deteriorating. The condition of our landscape in this country is really, really poor. Our dry land areas, which again is much of the West, 70% of that land is in the process of desertifying. So, you know, let's take a look at that. One challenge is that people see a landscape and assume that it's always been that way. But that isn't the case. If you look at history, you'll see, just, you might look at a landscape and then find out that, like, 2 generations ago, you know, it looks dry, but then there were, you know, a series of seasonal streams or year-round streams. So, yeah, I think that's important. I really got a sense of that when I was visiting Chihuahua, Mexico, because we looked at some really, you know, really rough kind of clearly non-productive land, you know, just like tumbleweeds and mesquite and otherwise kind of just bare. And my host said, when I was growing up, the best grass was here.
It's there's a term in fisheries that's called the tragedy of the commons, right? When and much of that open land is a similar type perspective. What we seem to write into our historical narrative is the wonderful herds of buffalo that used to roam that area, and now that they're gone, that we haven't made that correlation, that that's also impacting the landscape, as you mentioned. And same with fish and large trophic level fish in our fisheries and the whole ecosystem. So it seems maybe we're all due for a course of systems thinking. Maybe that'll help us, and maybe I can introduce that into a broader curriculum, not just in schools, but as we all become more awake to these planetary impacts that we're having on the way we're feeding ourselves.
That's right, because basically life creates, in nature, life creates more life. So, and again, I saw this in Mexico because I had gone there because bird conservation organizations were working with these ranchers to create habitat for endangered migratory grassland birds. And so the more cattle managed properly, the better the soil was, the better the grasses were, the more habitat for birds. And so they were seeing much more bird life and insect life. So it's not zero sum. That's what we need to get. It's more and more.
Would you like to maybe tease our audience a bit about what you're working on next, your next book?
Sure. Yeah, I'm in the throes of it right now. It's a book on ecosystem restoration, basically articulating a growing movement of regenerative agriculture and eco-restoration that's kind of quiet, happening in the margins, often happening in remote, desertified landscapes where people are really finding incredible new ways to improve landscapes. And I also have a narrative thread of restoring land here in Vermont. Because what I found with these books is that people would say, well, that's great that they've done all this stuff in Zimbabwe. What can I do right here on my land? And I realized, you know what? It's time to really answer that. And the truth is that restoring the earth starts here, starts right in front of you, wherever you are. You know, if you live in an apartment, maybe there's a neighborhood park or a courtyard, but every bit matters. You know, every acre matters. When we look at that metric that I said, that every gram of soil carbon represents 8 grams of water, you know, so when you're talking about a neighborhood, when you're talking about, you know, I mean, look, people can look around right now since having these sheep. Whenever I see just plain old grass, just like big lawns or you know, next to the parkway, or I keep thinking, wow, that would be great food for sheep. You know, there should be goats there. There should be sheep there. You know, when you think about it, that could be land that's holding water. That could be land that's creating fiber and food for people. So everywhere there are opportunities to, you know, build biodiversity, improve the water holding capacity of the land so there's fewer floods, and basically, restore ecological systems.
Well, I look forward to reading that one as well. Where can our audience learn more about your publication? Is it you have a website?
I have a website, and it's just my name, judithdschwartz.com. And Cows Save the Planet is published by Chelsea Green, and Water in Plain Sight is published by St. Martin's Press. And the new book, which is called Restoration Flash Mob, will be out with Chelsea Green. But of course, I've got to write it first.
Details, right? Details.
Yeah. I'm in it. Right now I'm in the desert, and I'm telling you, I mean, I am completely stunned and awed by some extraordinary work that's going on in deserts to bring them back to life, to bring moisture to the deserts.
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, what Alan Savory has done for us all and many of his disciples, I'm encouraged. I do believe, and I think you're absolutely onto something, that landscape restoration as an empowerment tool for anyone, anyone, whether it's local or locale, that is an opportunity. And if you throw into the mix the potential of jobs creation, food, quality food generation, businesses, bioregional economy development, well, we can get a lot of stakeholders behind some of those that enthusiasm and excitement.
Absolutely.
So, well, you know, Judith, I can't thank you enough for partaking in today's conversation. I learned a great deal. I'm sure our listening audience will learn a great deal. I'll include links at the bottom of the write-up for our episode so people can get access to that. I'll just say until next time, and thanks again for partaking in the conversation.
Oh, my pleasure.
Take care.